Welcome back, and I hope everyone's having a great week. Today on the podcast, I have a conversation with Jay Haas Jr. Jay was very gracious with his time. We spent almost 2 hours together, and it was a lot of fun talking with Jay. And we touch on a number of different subjects, and really to focus on some of the main points, we talk about the pressure he had on him growing up as the namesake of his dad, Jay Sr., one of, you know, extremely successful PGA Tour career. We talked through the trials and tribulations of his early life, and then getting into golf as a high schooler and going through college, and then him trying to make it on tour for a few years where he played professionally for 8 to 10 years or so. Ended up being a caddy for his brother Bill, and they had a lot of success together. And then we get into what he's doing now and how he is giving back and coaching kids and seniors and really anybody at the Haas Family Golf Center in Greenville, South Carolina. I got a chance to go out there and spend some time with Jay Jr., and I can tell you, I love his outlook about coaching and his coaching style, and he helped my game really right away. So I really enjoyed the conversation. I hope you guys do too. If you do, please give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcast. The most important thing we can all focus on right away for good health is sleep. It is something we all do, and for a lot of us, it's something we don't pay enough attention to, and it can all start with your mattress. And Engineered Sleep, the team at Engineered Sleep, they do an incredible job about working with you and finding the best mattress for you as easy as possible. That is their main goal, to work with you, see what type of mattress you need to optimize your performance on a daily basis, and that's what they'll do. So reach out to the team at Engineered Sleep, use promo code LIVE10. You can go visit them at their showroom in Greenville, South Carolina, or go to their website, engineeredsleep.com. Use promo code LIVE10. You'll get 10% off your order, and most importantly, you'll start living and sleeping better. And without further ado, here is my conversation with Jay Haas Jr. Welcome to Live Life in Motion, where the goal is to bring you conversations that give you the power of education, so you can use those tools to optimize your life on a personal and professional level to better yourself, your community, and those around you. Jay, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm excited to have you in studio.
It's nice to be here. Thanks for having me, Sam.
Yes, we're gonna cover a lot, but I want to start off with your childhood. You're the oldest of five. Your dad was on tour. What was life at home growing up?
Crazy. I mean, I just had a conversation a few months ago with my brother about how are we still alive right now? The stuff that we did, you know, obviously there with five kids, you're kind of required to take care of yourself a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I think when you grow up, we grew up in Travelers Rest, and you know, there's almost no traffic. You can kind of go wherever you want. We were at Green Valley, and we didn't think about, you know, cars driving by the you know, front of our house or anything. And we would take scooters up to the neighbor's yard, and there's a big slope that would go down and go across the road there. And, you know, we didn't even think, maybe we should have a lookout. You know, there might be a car coming. No. We're just flying down this hill. I don't understand. How do we even make it through that time? And it was a lot of fun. But there was a lot of, I mean, you know, we're all about the same age. There was a lot of competition. There was a lot of, like any brother and sister and all that stuff, you know, like there was some bickering and everything, and everybody wanted to have what they, you know, what the other person had and all this other stuff. But we really, I think as we've gotten older, we really appreciate having each other, you know. Like,
were you and Bill ever beating up on each other?
Oh, God, every day. And I think that talking about being competitive, we both did the same things. We were, you know, we're 14 months apart. Like, we were on the same teams. We played the same sports. We played mostly actually basketball. growing up. We played t-ball, stuff like that. We didn't really play golf until we moved to Thornblade area. And I mean, we played a little bit, but nothing crazy. There weren't a whole lot of players at Green Valley that were our age. And so I think we were more like, well, let's go play some basketball. Let's go do something else. Let's go, you know, play in the creek on the golf course, not hit balls on the golf course. And I think the basketball part really made us competitive. And we were never one of those. If it was just the two of us off somewhere, we didn't know anybody around, whatever, we really looked out for each other. But as soon as we were back home and had all our friends around, we were like, no, I'm gonna win, you know. we really went at each other a lot and had a lot of fun doing it. It didn't matter what it was, we were trying to beat each other.
So I was gonna ask, so your dad didn't throw you into golf right away?
No, he never pushed it. Yeah, I say that. Maybe when we were two, you know, he was, you know, giving us club, you know, whatever club. Actually, I have a club. It's like, I don't know, it's about a foot and a half long, and it's an old persimmon driver. It's mm-hmm. the smallest head. I'm sure you've seen one. And actually, I grew up playing persimmon woods, which tells you how old I am. It has my birth date on it and everything, and it's got a leather wrap grip on it. And nice. I'm not kidding. I think the shaft is about a foot and a half long. So I'm sure that, and that's what my great uncle is, Bob Golby. He's the one, I guess, apparently that made it for me and cut this thing down. And anyway, so I'm sure that when I could stand up, my dad's like, okay, here you go. You know, like, see if you can hit it. But I don't really ever remember him saying, come on, let's go hit, you know, like, you got to go hit balls. You got to go whatever. He always said, well, you want to go play baseball? You want to go throw the football? Yeah. You want to go, you know, play basketball? That was kind of, I think being on the golf course was his job. So bringing us out there was like bringing kids to work. Mm-hmm. And so when he was out there, he was working and having to, you know, chase us around because we didn't want to sit there and grind and hit balls. Yeah. We wanted to just, you know, whatever. We wanted to go play off somewhere else. And so I think I remember him saying one time that he came back one day from taking us to a golf course and he said, that's it, never taking him again.
Hey, I did see your brother with all three on the golf course on the range the other day. Mm-hmm. So
he tries to get him out there. And I think our patience levels, you know, we've taken after our dad, obviously. And so I think it definitely stresses our patience when we mm-hmm. take our kids out.
I remember actually one of the girls, like, you know, hit it like 15 yards off the driving range and she like ran out there and picked the ball up. And he was like, no, like, you got to come back. When did you realize your dad was on tour, like this incredible golfer? Like, when did that hit you as a kid?
I was probably older. I don't remember, honestly. Mm-hmm. I remember people would ask me, probably in late middle school, early high school, what's that like? And people today have asked me, you know, what was it like growing up with your dad being on tour and being gone all the time? And that was something that, because we grew up with it, it's like anything. If you're used to it, that's mm-hmm. normal.
Yeah.
And to me, it was almost better. Number one, when we got in trouble, he wasn't there. So it wasn't quite as bad until he got home. So a lot of times we would get a couple weeks before he'd come home and then we'd hear about it. Mm-hmm. But when he was home all the time. You know, like, he would go to the golf course when we were at school, but, you know, he would come pick us up at school and all that stuff. So it was almost like he was home just as much, it almost seemed, if not more, than somebody working a 9-to-5 when they would come home. And now, when I come home, I feel like I hardly ever get to spend time with my kids because we're trying to get them in bed at 7:30, which in the summertime right now is like,
yeah, it's light out.
That does not work.
Yeah. You know?
So, but I do remember, you know, thinking, what do you mean? When people would ask me that, what's that like? I'm like, well, what do you mean? It's normal. You know, that's my dad. Like,
that makes sense. I mean, it's just the life you knew.
Yeah.
What, You went to Riverside. Uh-huh. Did you play golf there?
Yes. Yeah.
Is that when did you start like, all right, I'm gonna try and be good at golf?
And that's what we moved to the Greer, Thornblade area when I was 11.
Okay.
And that later that year when we were at school, there were a couple guys that we kind of met playing out at Thornblade, and they went to school with us that were about the same age that were good at golf, and that kind of pushed us to want to go play a little mm-hmm. bit. So it was around 11. And Bill, who got a jump on me because he started when he was 10, he ended up making the high school team in seventh grade. We both tried out when I was in eighth grade and he was in seventh grade. And I didn't make the team and he made the team. But when you're in seventh grade, you can't play. You know, you're just on the team and you get to practice with everybody. Yep. And kind of, it's more like a grooming kind of thing. You know, like you get to watch good players and improve that way. But I did make it my ninth grade year. So I played, you know, ninth, 10th, 11th, 12th grade.
When you were going through high school, was your goal to go to college and play golf?
Yeah, actually that is really funny. So growing up with your dad who plays golf as his job, you're like, yeah,
it's got to be pressure too. Yeah.
Well, that's what going to tournaments in high school. Now, when I was in middle school, we hadn't really played that much. And we went to maybe a few like South Carolina Junior Golf Association tournaments in seventh grade, eighth grade, or whatever, and we were terrible. You know, and everybody's going, "Oh, it's Jay Haas Junior."
Yeah.
Jay Haas is like, "Oh my God!" What? And then I'd shoot 85, you know, or 90, and people were going, "Wow, I guess he had a bad round." But that didn't affect me until I was in high school. I never thought about it because I didn't really play. You know, I had fairly low expectations of my scoring. I had very high expectations of my ball striking, how I hit it and everything. Fred Couples was at our house all the time. He and my dad were good buddies. And so he's over there hanging out. You know, I watched Fred play when I was growing up, and Curtis Strange and my dad. And what I thought was a good golf shot was probably a lot better than what most people my age thought was a good golf shot.
You were judging off of like the purest hitters.
Yes, yes.
You know, some of all time.
Yes. And so I had very high standards for what should have been, you know, maybe like what I watch today, what an 11 and 12 year old, you know, what their good shot should be is much, much worse than what I thought a good shot should be. But anyway.
And moving on, I mean, you definitely obviously had some success in high school. And you decided to go to play at Augusta State. Did you ever think about other schools? Like, what led you to Augusta State?
The coach. When I was in high school, my coach, the guy that I kind of bounced ideas off of, went to see every now and then, was the head pro at Thornblade, was Daniel Sewell, and his brother was Jay Sewell. And I guess Daniel said something to Jay, "You should come, you know, watch Jay Jr. play, see what you think. I think he's got a lot of potential, whatever." And at the time, my uncle Jerry had been coaching at Wake Forest for about 3 years when I was a senior in high school. And I really didn't play good until my senior year.
And what was good? Like, what did you start shooting?
Your
handicap?
Low 30s in nine-hole matches. Yep. I shot, I think my stroke average was around 32.
Dang.
When I was in 12th grade, when I was a senior. But before that, it was not good. It was 37, 38, something like that. And then all of a sudden, something clicked. And I started making every putt I looked at and hit it kind of good, you know. And so all of a sudden my stroke average dropped a lot and I was playing really well. And I hadn't played any tournaments. It was mostly just matches. But all of a sudden I think Jay, he came out and watched me play. And he said, "You are the worst lag putter I've ever seen in my life."
And were you running him by?
Yes. And he said, but you might be the best putter from 10 feet and in I've ever seen in my life too. He said, because I guess whenever he watched me play, if I had anything outside of 25 feet, I would either leave it 10 feet short or run it 10 feet by him, but then I would make it. And so he thought, all right, well, we got something to work with. And Jerry, like I said, Jerry was at Wake, and he said, I don't have a scholarship for you, but if you want to come play, there's a spot on the team.
So you could have gone to Wake?
Yes. And I did. I thought about it, but...
Because that's where your dad went, right?
Yes. And Bill went there.
Yep.
And my sister Fran went there.
Mm-hmm.
But I...
Augusta State has a good team too, though.
Yeah. And it's... It's... what is it? It's the University of Augusta now?
Yes.
I think that's right. I don't know. I say I think that's right because it was Augusta State, and then it was the Georgia Regents University.
I didn't know that one.
Yeah. There was a whole thing about that. Like there was a big petition that everybody signed, you know, to have the name changed again. And when I was there, it was mostly foreign kids, actually. And I don't know how that started, but it was almost like the foreign kids from England and Scotland, they almost recruited each other to come there. And it, you know...
And it's Augusta National.
Yes, that was what it was. Augusta National was there. They kind of said, all right, well, if you come, we got to play there once a year.
I'm coming.
Yeah. And anyway, so when I was there, we were very, very good. And I think maybe my junior year, I think we won 7 times or something like
Dang.
That.
And that is rare for college golf.
Well, yeah, basically every tournament we played in, we won. And until the end of the season, we kind of started to, you know, not play quite as good.
Mm-hmm.
And we ended up finishing 5th at Nationals that year. And that was before the match play started. The match play, I don't know, I can't remember. That's been the last, whatever, 7 years or something.
Did you and Bill ever face each other in college?
We never played against each other never played in the same group. Now, our teams, because of Jerry and Bill... and Jay Sewell, obviously, he and Jerry are very similar in their coaching styles. They're a lot of fun to be around, and they push their players, but they have a lot of fun doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very, very, you know, excited the whole time, you know, whatever, they're pulling for everybody. And so I think they got along really well because of that. And so now Bill and I are on opposite teams, but everybody ended up being pretty good buddies. And it's funny, I feel like I keep in touch with the guys that went to Wake at the same time as I was going to Augusta State more than the guys that I went to Augusta State with. Number one, because most of the guys that I played with on like the traveling team were from England, Scotland.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, true.
We had a kid from Sweden. And so they, you know, they've gone back home.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't talk to them very much. But like we had Oliver Wilson on our team, who's, you know,
yeah,
European Tour player, and Jamie Elson, he was the number one player, and he turned pro, and I don't know what he's, I think he's maybe teaching now or something like that, but I do know he played on the European Tour for a while, and Scott Jameson, who's still playing on the European Tour. So we had a lot of good, very good European players.
Yeah.
And so we played kind of, we were head to head for a long time. I think at the end of the year, we ended up nipping them every year.
Dang.
I think that's right.
You got him.
But I think my sophomore year when Bill was a freshman, they were very, very, very good. Wake was. I think they were number one in the nation going in regionals and all that stuff. And they ended up missing by one or two or something, not making it to Nationals.
Oof.
My junior year.
Golf is such a game like that too.
Yes. Yeah. And it's such a, what have you done for me lately kind
yeah.
of sport. You know, like it doesn't matter how you played last year or last week or whatever. It's
mm-hmm.
how you playing right now.
Live Life in Motion podcast is brought to you by Engineered Sleep. Engineered Sleep is a mattress manufacturer, and they are based out of Greenville, South Carolina. They have been making mattresses for as long as I can remember, and their main goal is to make finding the quality mattress for you as easy as possible. They have a showroom in Greenville, but you can also visit them at their website, engineeredsleep.com. If you go to their website, use code LIVE10 and you will get 10% off. As you guys know, sleep is the number one thing you need to focus on for good health. And it all starts with your mattress. So stop putting it on the back burner. Go get yourself a mattress from Engineered Sleep and start living a better life. What about, so your career, you know, at Augusta State, y'all are obviously, y'all have some good success. Mm-hmm. And then is that, did you go directly to mini tour where you're like, all right, I'm going to try and make it?
Yes. Yeah. And I, see, I'm trying to think when I first started trying to play, I maybe caddied for my dad a few times to make some money to yep. to go play with. And I played the Grey Goose Gateway Tour in Myrtle Beach. And that was, I did not practice enough. I'm in Myrtle Beach, I'm 22, you know, I'm living with my buddies. We've all just turned pro. And you know, I played so bad.
So would y'all just play courses around Myrtle Beach?
Yes. We kind of basically from lower, you know, coastal North Carolina to all the way down to Beaufort.
Yeah.
I don't think we ever played. We never played on Hilton Head Island, but we did play like right, you know, just short of the island. And we had so much fun. Like we were basically in college without school. Is basically playing what golf. It felt like. Yes, playing golf. So we had a great time. I learned that most of the guys that spent a lot of time on the golf course not playing ended up playing better than everyone else, regardless of what their game looked like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that taught me a little bit about how not to just rely on talent or rely on, okay, well, you know, yeah, I'm hitting it fine. It's no big deal. Whatever. Let's, you know, let's go play. Because when you play and you're not playing for anything and there's no stress, you know, at a certain level, you can almost shoot, you know, 5 under every time you tee it up. But as soon as there's a little bit of pressure, all of a sudden you're shooting 75 every time you tee them. You go, what is going on? And it's just because you don't trust yourself. And so those guys that would grind, you know, I'd watch him play and I'm going, there's no way that guy shot 7 under today. It's impossible. I've watched him hit balls. He can't do it. But because they trust what they're doing, because they've worked on it so mm-hmm. hard, it literally, especially at that level, it's all just grinding.
I think I'm like a 6 handicap right now. But I was telling you, I've tried to incorporate like a draw into my game, uh-huh. right? And it has made me struggle at some point, say like missing both ways, but the ultimate goal is like it's going to click one day.
Yep.
And it's going to make me better. I mean, like you said, Tiger Woods, he went through swing changes and people thought he was crazy.
Yeah.
Because he, you know, was off for 18 months but then became the best golfer of all time again.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think his best swing was kind of early 2000s.
That's the Tiger Slam days.
For him, for his body, whatever, you know, whatever. And I think his newer swing looks a lot like that swing.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that everyone's the same. I don't care how good you get at anything. The reason you got there is because you were always trying to get better. And the reason he was the best was because he was always trying to get better. And once he felt like he hit a plateau, he said, I don't feel like I'm getting any better now. I need to figure out a way to get better.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was why he went through those swing changes trying to get better. And actually, Bill Harmon told me that he asked Tiger one time, you know, what he was working on with Hank Haney. And he said, because Bill couldn't figure out what they were, you know, like where he was going with his swing, because he liked what his swing was before.
Mm-hmm.
And he I can't remember all the stuff that he said, he basically said when he first started doing it, it was the best he'd ever hit it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's saying something. That's Tiger Woods saying that's the best I've ever hit it.
Yeah.
Wow. How good was that?
That's like the best ever.
Right. And then he kind of, and then after that, he was sort of, it's almost like he, it went into a lull and he chased it for a long time getting back there. And that was kind of, I think that might have been when he started to get pretty loose with his driver. But I saw a really cool thing. Yeah, I went back and looked at some of his stats, and his driving was obviously not very good. But even though he missed, I think he was very, very high on fairways hit, as far as I think he's like 150th or something like that.
Yeah,
in driving into the fairway. Now his now because he hit it so far, kind of like Bryson, what yeah. Bryson's doing now, because he hits it so far, he can miss fairways, and now all of a sudden he's got wedges and lob wedges into greens that guys are back, you know, hitting seven irons. So they better hit the fairway,
yeah.
Because if they don't, they're at a big disadvantage.
And isn't that a new kind of concept in golf? I mean, not new.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. So if you hit it farther than everybody off the tee, you also hit your irons farther.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you're both 150 out, the guy that hits it farther is hitting less club.
Yep.
And if you have more loft on a club, is easier to control, especially, you know, from the rough or whatever. If you can swing a little easier at it, what feels like you're swinging easier at it,
yeah,
it's easier to control. And the straighter the face is, the harder it is to hit it the distance you want out of rough, especially on tour, because they grow, you know, most of those courses, they've got the yeah. rough long, and the rough's a little bit unpredictable, or it's very, very thick and hard to get the ball out. So if you're hitting lob wedge instead of 8-iron or 7-iron, that's a huge advantage. That being said, you still have to putt well. I don't care how good you hit it. If you don't putt good, you're not going to do well.
What's a goal for an amateur on the green? Two putt?
Yes. Yeah. And to me, amateurs should really work on their lag putting. That's especially beginning golfers. You know, guys that have maybe been playing for a year or two, and they're trying to figure out how they can get better. They feel like they hit it maybe okay, or at least know where it's going,
mm-hmm.
but still can't hardly break 90. It's around the greens. And if you kind of figure out, most people I've found tend to have terrible lag putting. And if you hit a putt that goes, let's say you hit a putt that's a foot offline, and it's perfectly whole mm-hmm. high when you know, like it's the perfect distance. Well, you got a 1 foot tap in.
I would love those.
Yeah, yeah. Now, let's say you hit one directly at it. It's a perfect read, but it's a little too hard, and it lips out, and it goes by 5 feet. Well, you hit the hole. It almost went in, but it didn't. Now you got a 5 foot putt that you're kind of grinding over, and you don't really, I don't know, you know, which, it hit the lip, and now it kind of broke a little to the right. When is it kind of, did you really pay attention to that? I don't know. And so it's just, you save a lot of shots by being good at hitting it the right speed.
Mm-hmm.
And it does make reading greens a lot easier too. If you can hit it the right speed, it's way easier to read your putt.
back to the mini tours. I've always, you know, you always hear these like crazy stories of people on the mini tours and like trying to survive and grind and make money. Is there a story that sticks out to you that, it could be about golf, it could be about nightlife, it could be about anything that you saw go on the mini tours?
Yeah, that...
Or too many to tell, I don't know.
So I get myself in trouble. No. Do it. I think most of the guys, everybody really had fun because, you know, you're not making much money. You try to travel with each other. You try to, you know, stay together or whatever it is. You play practice rounds together. That's when you make your best friends, because you're trying to, you know, succeed at something that's hard to succeed at. And everybody, to a certain extent, supports each other. Now, that being said, I don't think anybody out there cared what the other person was doing swing-wise, whatever. Now, there were certain guys that I was really good friends with, and we were always trying to help each other, stuff like that. But it was just some guy that you know, had met while you were out there, and y'all, you know, got along fine on the golf course. My dad used to tell me this, I love this. He said, nobody wants to hear about your round. He said, number one.
I love that, too.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, number one, half the guys don't care, and the other half wish you'd done worse. He said, so don't sit there and rehash around. You know, nobody wants to hear that. And there were definitely guys that had never been told that. And so, you know, you'd have to sit there, like, after the round, and they'd go over, and you're like, yeah.
Man, if I would have had this butt back, yes, or this yes. happened there.
And that's normal, because you're kind of, you know, like, you're... If you have a bad day, you need some kind of support, or you need to, like, get it out and all mm-hmm. that stuff. So I get it. But to talking about traveling and being with everybody and all that stuff, I played the Tar Heel Tour, which became the E-Golf Tour.
Okay.
And one of the last few years that I was playing, two of the last few years I was playing, the tour went to Morocco to play. And it was a co-sanctioned event with the Challenge Tour, which is like the European Tour's version of the Korn Ferry Tour. And the first year you had to qualify to go. There was maybe 10 guys that went that qualified. And somehow I ended up getting in because somebody couldn't go. Like, it was based on performance of the last three tournaments or something like that.
So you're like an alternate.
Yes. And I had no idea I was an alternate. All of a sudden I got a call from the guy that ran the tour. He's like, hey, so you're in for Morocco. And I was like, no, I'm not. Like, I looked and I'm definitely not. He said, no, you are, because so-and-so backed out and all this stuff. They couldn't go. And I said, all right, well, yeah, let's go. And that was maybe one of the most fun trips I've ever had. Like, we had so much fun. They had parties for us there. Like, it was awesome. And there was we stayed in a hotel. El Jadida was the name of the golf course there. And I think, I can't remember that might have been the name of the town too. But there was a hotel with a casino right up the street. And we got to go up there and, you know, gamble and everything. And it was, I can't remember the name of the money they have there. I
feel like it starts with a currency D. or something?
Yeah, yeah. I feel like there's a D in it, or starts with a D. I can't remember. Anyway, but it was like 7-1 was the exchange rate. And so, you know, like, you got like $100 or whatever it is. And, you know, you start doing the math. You're like, I don't know, what is that, like $15 or $12? I don't know, I can't remember. And then you say, oh, whatever, just put $100 down. And, you know, by the end of it, some of the guys made a ton, way more money gambling than they did playing golf, because that was all they did while they were there. They had so much fun. And then the next year we got to go to Marrakesh and play there. And actually, the Champions Tour just went and played a tournament last year, two years ago, at the same course.
Nice.
And I just remember it was brand new, and it was running fast, and it was hard, and I think I was 500 through 12 or something. And the next thing I know, I made like a double and three bogeys. I'm like, wait a second, what just happened? I was in the lead, and now I'm 100th. You know, like,
that's golf.
Yeah, that is golf. And but that was cool, because I got robbed one night. We all went out,
man.
And it was like a 10-year-old.
We starting all, early.
Yeah, and that was apparently that happened a lot. But anyway, I was kind of like, I'm trying to get in this cab to go back to the hotel where we're staying. And I'm pulling my money out. All of a sudden, I've got everybody around me. We're all getting in the same cab. All of a sudden, this little hand comes in and grabs it. And by the time I turn around,
runs off.
He was so fast, the kids should run in the Olympics or something. it was amazing, because I was like, what just happened? And he was like, I bet he was 20 yards away in an instant. And I was like, oh my God, what is happening? Like, we are not doing this ever again. Like, we're not leaving the hotel. We're just going straight back and forth. And I think it ended up being about $100 he got American from me, which mm-hmm. at the time was a lot of money, because, you know, you're grinding out there and everything.
Yeah.
But I'm sure the kid needed it. You know, I mean, like, they, whatever. Anyway.
Forgiveness,
yeah.
man.
There yeah, you go. Yeah, well, that's what, and that, I mean, what was I going to do about it? You know, he was already gone. But I remember thinking, it's like, wow, can't wait to tell this story when I get home. Like, I just
got robbed.
Yeah, I just got robbed. And then people are like, what do you mean you got robbed? Like,
by a 10-year-old.
Yeah, by a 10-year-old.
Did you, Were there any guys that would party too hard and miss tee times? And
Oh, yeah. And that, you know, that actually didn't happen a whole lot. I missed a tee time one time because the tournaments always started on a certain day and they changed the day for a tournament. And I showed up to play my practice round and everybody's out there. And I'm like, what's going on? And
this is probably pre, like, everything's on your cell phone.
You know, and it, yeah, that was, like, you could check it on the internet. And I think, you know, I had a, you know, I had an Android phone at the time, I think. I think the iPhone was out, I think. Maybe not. Yeah, I don't know, I'm pretty old.
iPhone came out in 07.
Then probably not.
Something like that.
Yeah, then it probably wasn't out yet. I think I probably had a BlackBerry at the time. Yeah, because everybody did.
Yeah, know, those were the thing, man. Yeah, they were great.
Yeah, but yeah, I do. I whiffed a tee time, thinking that it was going to be a practice round day, and then there was somebody whiffed a tee time leading the golf tournament. I'm trying to think of who that was, and it was just a little 2-day event, and I think his tee time was at like 1 o'clock, and he had a big night the night before. Oof. and you know, didn't go to bed till 6 in the morning or whatever, and just slept right through it.
Yeah. Playing golf hungover is horrible too.
Well, that's what I've found as I've gotten older. That, man, if you sleep funny the night before, your golf game's bad.
Yeah.
Like, it's amazing. That I remember when I was younger, I was like, no, that's not what it was. You know, it's not because I didn't get a good night's sleep. It's not because I was out drinking or whatever. It's just because something's not clicking today. You know, I'm my swing's off or whatever. I never thought, well, maybe I should have gone to bed at 8:30 and, you know, whatever else. Or maybe I should start stretching a little bit. Never thought that. That was what my wife now, when we were first dating, she would get on to me. You need to start stretching and doing yoga and stuff, like, because when you get older, you know, you're not going to move very
It's going to get harder.
Yes. And I'm going, no, whatever. No big deal. I don't need to do that. And even today, you know, I'll stretch a little bit, but I would say my stretching is hitting balls. That's like,
what when did you start saying, all right, now I'm gonna caddy? Or did you kind of like caddy and try and make it on tour?
When I basically quit. There was about 2 years.
Do you know
when
this was?
Yes, 2010. I played really well. Asked my wife to marry me. So I got engaged, played very well, ended up missing at second stage by a couple shots because I three putted three times on the back nine. I was so mad. And I went out, but like I said, I had been playing really well. And then all of a sudden in 2011, I did not play good. And I don't know if it was the stress of being worried about, you know, getting married, whatever it was, I was not playing well. And my dad said to me, I think it had to be late in the season. It was because it was right before the PGA in 2011. And he said something to me like, you ought to go caddy for Bill, you know, make a little money and you can keep playing. He's like, he's got four tournaments left or whatever before before the playoffs start. And, you know, you can make a little cash and then you can go to Q school with that. I'm like, oh yeah, that's a good idea. And so I said something to Bill about it. He's like, yeah, come caddy for me. You know, I need somebody to look for me right now anyway. And so I did. So I went and caddy for him at the Greenbrier was the first tournament. And he lost in a playoff.
Dang.
To Scott Stallings. And then
did you caddy for Scott?
I did caddy for Scott. And
he was impressed by it.
Yeah. And then the next week might have been the PGA or the week after that. I can't remember. And Bill finished 11th, which at the time was his best finish in a major. And so we were working well together.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad said something like, you ought to caddy for him, you know, in the playoffs too. Like he's playing good. You know, you're making good money. Might as well, you know.
Yeah.
Finish it out. You can practice while you're on the road and stuff like that. And so I said something to Bill, and Bill, you know, he said, yeah, come on. And that was when See, he played okay in the first event, maybe not great in the second event. And then the third event, playoff event, he was leading with nine holes to play and got nervous and started pressing a little bit, whatever, and didn't play good. He might have shot four over or something on the back nine and ended up finishing 20th or something. But he was close. He, obviously, he'd been playing well.
Yeah, he was right there.
Yes. And then that at the Tour Championship, that was when he won and hit that shot out of the water and everything. Mm-hmm. And so I was caddying for him there. And
in the pink shirt, I think.
I could have had a pink shirt
on. I think
on.
He had a pink shirt.
Oh, he did have a pink shirt on. Yes, yeah. He did. That's right.
You see that shot like every Tour Championship.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Pink shirt, maybe black pants. but he, that week, I have so many stories about caddying for him and other caddies telling stories. And but that week was fun because we were, obviously, Bill was playing well, mm-hmm. and he was all stressed out, you know, because he's, you know, he wants to do really well. Now, he was 19th, maybe, somewhere around 20th.
Oh, in the rankings. The
yes. And I don't think today that you could win if you're that high.
Like, I don't like how they changed it, actually.
Yeah. Well, and to me, it's very confusing. Or it was very confusing. Now I guess it's simpler, but it's very strange to start at 10 under.
Yes.
For the tournament. That's very odd.
And if you're starting like, if he was 20th, he'd probably be starting like 3 under
right,
or something.
Right. And so to wrap your head around that initially was, I think, is hard. I think the more you get to see it, everybody's going to be, whatever, no big deal. But I think at the time, I think he was 19th, and Hunter Mahan, who ended up losing to the playoff, was around 17th, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there were like 8,000 scenarios about who could win, how they were going to win, all this stuff. And Bill played with Luke Donald on Sunday, and I think Luke was like third coming into the tournament, and he ended up finishing third or fourth. Something like that.
So he would have been close to winning.
So we assumed, and Webb Simpson was leading the points coming into the tournament, and he ended up finishing 25th or 27th.
Yeah. So he had to finish low.
He had a bad week. And so Bill and I are both thinking, you know, Luke's going to win.
Mm-hmm.
Because, he's third in the points. You know, he just finished third or fourth in the tournament. Like, he's definitely going to win. And it actually ended up happening. It had to happen that way because of the way everything broke down. Bill and Hunter had to finish that way in order for Bill to win or for Hunter to win. Like I don't even know if Hunter was one shot worse, he'd have finished tied for second. And the tie for second would have been with Luke, and Luke would have won.
So it would have taken him up to a spot.
So they had to finish and go into a playoff the way they did for them to win.
Dang.
Either one of them to win. So it was like a perfect storm.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Hunter, he hit the ballsiest drive I've ever seen on 17 in the playoff. And the playoff was what is now the ninth hole, which is the par three. The 240 yard par three, whatever it is. And the eighth hole, the par four with the water on the left right there, that was 17. And Hunter hit this cut off the lake and right in the dead center of the fairway. And I was like, oh my God, I cannot believe he just did that. Like, really? And obviously he knew he was going to hit a cut. He was playing good or whatever. But I just remember thinking, I was like, oh my God, that was wow. Okay. And then just flagged his second shot in there right over the pin, about 20, maybe 25 feet past the hole, but it was right at it, like just two of the prettiest shots you've ever seen. And Bill didn't like that tee shot at all. Like, he likes to play a draw, but he was concerned of overdrawing it there and getting it running down to the left mm-hmm. in the water. And so he would bail out to the right, which was totally fine. Like, if it went in the bunker, Bill's one of the best fairway bunker players I've ever seen in my life. He told me we got in an argument one time about how far the ball was going to go out of the bunker. And it was kind of like, it was on an upslope. It was 195 to cover the front or something like that. The hole was 200 and it was a little bit of hurt. And he says, you like six iron? I'm going, no, what? No, it's a five iron. And he said, well, you think so? And I said, yeah, well, I mean, it's like, there's a little bit of hurt and the ball doesn't really want to go as far out of the bunker. And then all of a sudden he went, what? Wait, no. The ball goes farther out of the bunker, doesn't it? And that's what he said to me. The ball goes farther out of the bunker. I'm going, no. Nobody, you're the only person on the planet who thinks that. and I'm not kidding. He did. He hit this six iron up there like 5 feet from the hole. It was amazing. I was completely blown away. And so anyway, so his ball, for some reason, he hits it farther out of the bunker than he does in the fairway. Now he's bailed out right on 17. It's in the bunker. And I think he had 145 to cover and 152 to the hole or 153 mm-hmm. to the hole or something. The front book, cover the front bunker, the front edge. And he wants to hit nine iron, just kind of like chip this nine iron up there because his pitching wedge was around a 140 club. And I said, I don't know. I feel like there's a little bit of help. Like, I think you should hit pitching wedge. Like, worst case scenario, it comes up short and it's in the front bunker and it's easy up and down. It's not a big deal. And I said, you can't be long because at his angle, it was going in the water.
Yeah.
And so, and sure enough, he flagged this thing. Like, I mean, it was from our angle, it was maybe a yard left of the pin, which is 3 feet left of the pin. I mean, it was such a good shot. And he's posing on it. We're both watching. All of a sudden, one hop right over the back.
Yeah.
And he turns and looks at me. He goes, where'd that go? I said, it went in the water.
Oh, God.
And I mean, we were both so upset. I was like, I just talked him into hitting less club. Like, that should have been the right play. You know, like, that was the perfect club. And so anyway, so we're both upset. We're, you know, running up there, or I'm trying to run up there and get in front of him after raking the bunker and just to see, you know, maybe it hung up on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked up and all of a sudden I saw it sitting there. I was like, oh my God, Bill, you can hit this thing. Like, it's not that it's in the water, but it's not in the water. And he didn't say a word, not one word. We never said a single word to each other. He just grabbed the lob wedge out. He walked down there, looked at it, walked up, looked at where the, you know, hole was, and he went back down and then he hit the shot.
Yeah.
And it was kind of one of those shots where, and he and I have talked about it, he was basically just making sure that he got it up there.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't care, you know, if it
yeah, at that point, he just wants a putt.
Yes. And the day before, he was playing with Dustin Johnson, or maybe that was on Thursday. Anyway, Dustin hit it down there, and it did hang up. But when he tried to get it up on the green, it looked like he took a pretty good swipe at it, and it didn't come out far. Like, he didn't hit it far enough, and it came back down to him a little bit. And so I guess Bill kind of knew that he needed to hit it harder than he thought, or harder than it looked like he needed to hit it. And it just, it was kind of like perfect storm sort of thing. You know, I can't believe it checked up. That was crazy.
And it's one of like the most replayed shots every year.
Yeah.
When the Tour Championship comes around.
Yeah, it is a very, very cool shot.
Live Life in Motion is brought to you by CBDMD. I am very pumped to have CBDMD as a partner. They are the most legitimate CBD company out there. All their products are THC free. They're all third-party tested. Really, they're trusted by a lot of the best athletes in the world. I've used CBD for a long time, and their products at CBDMD are simply the best. I love their gummies. Really, there's a lot of uses for CBD. I like to use it for sleep and really any type of recovery. It really can help inflammation. So go to their site, CBDMD.com. Look up some products and use promo code LIVE25 at checkout and you will save 25% off your order. So it's a pretty darn good deal. Go to CBDMD.com, use promo code LIVE25 at checkout and start living healthier. What's it like caddying at Augusta?
Hard. It's the way, I think it's, a lot of it is the, you know, the mystique of the place, whatever, like mm-hmm. you want to, but you know, especially hitting a shot into a green, that you you don't need to be perfect, but you need to be pretty close to it.
Mm-hmm.
And just because of the way the greens are, if you make a mistake, you'll have either one of the hardest putts or the hardest chips you've ever had in your life. And the greens are so fast. Some years I've been there and they're so fast, it's like you go, oh my gosh, they can't putt on these greens.
This past year they were super fast.
Yes. And they aren't, they're always perfect. You know, there's never a blemish on them. It's the craziest thing. They do an amazing job, obviously, keeping the place up and making it perfect for the tournament. And but it, the way that the holes are, you know, designed and all that stuff, and the way the trees are, if the wind blows there, it swirls. And I, this is the funniest story. I love this story. Teddy, who caddies for Bubba Watson, he was telling me about one time they were standing on the tee at 12, which is the par three there over the water, and something about, I guess he was talking to some guy, I have no idea who it is, but he was telling him about how the way that those holes are shaped, when the wind blows, it swirls like you see like in a creek or whatever, if there's a rock and the water's going past it, you can kind of see like little swirls
around.
Yeah, ripples and whatever, and it's like little whirlpools in the water there. Well, apparently that happens right there. And so if it feels like the wind's off the right on the tee, it might actually be off the left up by the green, or it could be straight in even though it feels like a straight down. And I mean, crazy stuff happens
and
right
you
there.
See crazy things happen.
That's why you see guys hitting in the water there and you go, well, how did they mess that up? It's 150 yards. You can't mess that up. You know, not at that level, but because of that level and how close they're trying to hit it, especially when they're pushing or they feel good about what they're doing, it doesn't take much. You know, it's a yard.
Yeah.
To all of a sudden, it's back in the water.
Unless you're Freddie.
Unless you're Freddie. And then they don't hang up. This is like magic. But anyway, so I guess this guy says something like, yeah, he says it's basically a wind eddy is what he called it, is what the guy said. And so Ted looks at Bubba and goes, you hear that, Bubba? He goes, if you hit it in the water here, don't blame Teddy, blame Eddie.
Is that was that around one of the years Bubba won?
Mm-hmm. That would have been, that probably was right before he won the first time. I think that's right.
Bubba is, I love watching Bubba. I'm glad he's made a little resurgence.
Yeah, he is, he's making a comeback. And I'm an instructor and I study swings and all that stuff. And he has obviously a very unique swing, but it's mostly just unique because of his follow through. A lot of the stuff that he does in his backswing, if you flip it around, it is actually amazing how much it looks like Jack Nicklaus's swing.
Okay.
Up to the top. Once they get to the top, things start to get a little different. But as they get to the top, the way that their leg position, their hand position, all that stuff, it looks very, very similar. But then all, down into it, and then the way that Bubba jumps back and hangs back on on his left side, that's very different from what Jack did.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that he swings requires him to shape the ball. You know, from a consistency standpoint, he should never really try to hit one straight. And I did see him one time hit a straight drive. It was the craziest thing. It was kind of downwind.
Did it go like 360 or something?
No, it was probably close to 400 yards it went.
Oh, God.
He flew it 340 something over this bunker. It was the 18th hole in Boston. And that was the first year I caddied for Bill. And he's playing, you know, obviously Bill's playing with him, and Bill was playing pretty good. And Bubba, on every hole, you know, he's hitting that like low slice, you know, every hole, right in the middle of the fairway. But it's like this low slice, and I'm going, well, he's going to kill one of these patrons over here walking on the, you know, by the ropes. Like, it was unbelievable. And so anyways, all the way around, same shot, low slice. And then on 18... He's talking with Teddy and they're kind of, you know, whatever, going back and forth. And next thing I know, he hits this high straight bomb, just straight at this bunker. I'm kind of, all of a sudden you know, I'm watching where this thing's going. And I'm like, I pull out my yardage book as it's flying through the air, and I'm looking down. And I'm like, that's like 343 or something to carry that bunker. There's no way it's going over that bunker. And sure enough,
over the
bunker. And I think he hit like, there's like a little chippy wedge in this par five. You know, I'd never seen anything like that. I was like, how did he do that? I mean, why didn't he try to hit it straight every time?
Yeah.
And but yet now I think he maybe, I don't know if he lost some of his, you know, touch or whatever as he's gotten older a little bit with his ball shaping and everything. But he has to, because of his swing, because of the steepness of his swing and how much he releases it and everything, he can't really play a straight shot, which if that's, you know, that's your imagination, you know, you like to see it, whatever.
Because he has courses that doesn't fit his eye, that don't fit his eye.
Yeah, like Hilton Head, you know, I would think he would struggle there because it's not wide enough for him to be able to shape it enough. Yeah,
the trees are too tall.
It's a little too tight. There's a few courses that are like that. And I'm sure, you know, every player has a course that just they step up on every tee and they go, nope, I'm not going to hit one good here. You know,
I mean, there's
still good.
Me being an amateur, I know there's like courses I play. Like, man, I hate this hole.
Yeah.
You know, and end up always bailing out. I'll be like 40 yards right because I knew I couldn't go left.
Right. And to me, that comes back to trust. You know, like if you trust yourself, even if it doesn't look good, you go, all right, well, I know what I'm doing. I trust what I'm doing. So I'm just going to go for it. And that's when you go from shooting, you know, okay scores to all of a sudden now you become pretty good.
So you mentioned you're an instructor. Mm-hmm. What are some swings on tour that you love to watch or study?
Currently,
yeah.
Tiger is a good one. Just because I would say his swing is very, very close to, you know, I won't say perfect, but it's because there's so little movement, you know, or direction change or whatever it is. It's almost like it's like a, what do you call it? It's like a mechanical.
Yeah. It's almost like a robot.
Yes. And so that's a good one, like a baseline. Okay. Well, if you were going to do it and be perfect with it, this is where you should go. Nobody should really do that. Nobody has time to practice and get like that. And so to me, everyone should have some kind of idiosyncrasy to their swing because everybody has an idiosyncrasy to their, you know, the way they walk, to the way they talk, the way they move their hands when they're talking, all that stuff, whatever. Mm-hmm. So everybody's swing should have that unique sort of thumbprint. But you don't teach that. Like, that just becomes what they do. So you kind of show them something like Tiger swing and say, well, just try to copy this. Let's see what you can do with this. Or try to feel like you're in this position here and let's see what you do there. And actually, it's funny. I use, I like Tiger swing. I really like Rory McIlroy's swing.
Whew, it's a pretty one.
It is pretty. Fred Couples. There's a couple of interesting things that I've seen about how their feet move and about how really good ball strikers move their feet in their swing, which is like they shouldn't move their feet, right?
Is it less or more movement?
More movement than you would think.
Okay.
But what I thought was really interesting is that both Rory and Fred and Bubba Watson and Matt Wolf.
He has that big.
Yeah, so it's
straight up.
And I use his swing to try to get people to lay the club down. Most people swing too much around in their backswing and their shoulders are real flat. And well, the ball's down on the ground. It's not out in front. Like it's not a tee ball.
Yeah.
So now all of a sudden, now you got to go back down again. And that makes the club too steep. So you almost want to be the opposite. You almost want to be steep and then lay it down on the way down. And so I use his swing as an example of, all right, let's try to copy this. Nobody gets there. Like, you can't get there. Nobody could do that.
Do you teach the little hitch too?
No, I don't. No. No. And actually, that's a Funny story, I was caddying for my dad 1 year somewhere. I can't remember where we were. But anyway, he was playing a practice round with Tiger. And Tiger was, he's like a big kid, kind of. Just to me, he was always very, very nice. Tried to, you know, have fun with me, whatever, when we were together.
And y'all are, he's a little bit older than you.
He's four or five years older than me.
Yep.
4 years older. But he could never have been nicer to me. And anyway, we were kind of talking, and he said, "Hey, you want to know how to hit it farther?" Just out of the blue. And
yes, Tiger.
Actually, that wasn't out of the blue, because I was giving him a hard time about this shot that he hit. He hit this 2-iron from the first cut of rough on this par 5. My dad had already hit. He had driver, 3-wood to layup, and he was going to have to hit wedge from there. So driver, 3-wood, wedge. Tiger's hitting 2-iron.
To the green, bro.
To the green. And he flags it. I mean, it was on a string straight at the pin, and it hit the bunker, the top lip of the bunker, and popped straight up in the air and then rolled back in. And I was like, oh my God, that was the best shot I've ever seen. You know, just to be there and see him hit this shot. And it was like 270 or something. The cover's like, he's got iron. What's happening?
In a practice round.
Yeah, in a practice round. And anyway, so I said something to him about it. And on the next hole, we're walking off the tee. He says, "Hey, you want to know how to hit it farther?" And I said, "Yeah, I want to know how to hit it farther." He's like, "Work out your butt." That's what he said. And I said, I was like, I kind of gave him a funny look. And he said, no, I'm serious. He said, "Work out your glutes." He's like, "That's where your power comes from." And I was like, yeah, sure, you know, whatever. I think I was in college at the time. I'm like, you know what he's talking about. Tiger Woods. You know, and I never did that. I never really worked out that hard. Mm-hmm. I hit it as far as I hit it. And that's what,
yeah,
you know, whatever. But I think if I had done that, I definitely would have picked up a lot of yardage, because now that I've kind of messed around with it, you definitely do hit it farther the more you can, you know, use your legs and mm-hmm. your butt.
I think that was a advantage to my game as being like a soccer player growing up. I always had a strong lower body.
Yep.
And I noticed being able to use the ground to like power through the ball. Right.
Right. Yep.
Or like generate that energy and power.
Yeah.
But I tell people that, like my buddies who are, you know, 15, 20 handicappers, are like, "What?" I'm like, "Dude, you should see your swing. You're just like throwing your arms back and yep. then throwing your arms through."
Yeah, I think everybody tries to have a stable base.
Mm-hmm.
And so their legs hardly move.
Yeah, their knees stay like the same direction.
Yes. And so then all of a sudden it becomes an upper body swing. And that's instant, like over the top slice, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, 95% to 98% of amateurs do that same wrong thing.
What can amateurs, what do you see the most common in amateurs?
That.
And it's a slice?
Yes. Yep. And I think most amateurs try to draw the ball by swinging left with their body. Like mm-hmm. they try to force it left, because that makes sense in baseball. You want to hit it left, so you try to get out a little bit early and make sure you're swinging left, right? You would, you know, you don't want to kind of do like that and come from the inside, because that's instant out to the right.
Yep.
Well, in golf, you have to, the whole reason a ball goes in whatever direction it's going in is actually it's like 70 to 90% the face, your face angle. The reason it shapes is 70, 90% or 100% the face angle compared to the path of your club.
How much joy does it bring you when you see people improve and like they actually have a smile on their face playing golf?
That's the whole reason that, you know, I like teaching, actually. That's the only reason that I like teaching. I like watching, never thought I would say this, but I do. I like watching someone change for the better, because I, you know, whether I told them something that was unique that they had never heard before, or that the way that I presented it to them was slightly unique mm-hmm. that they had never heard before, that helped them to get to where they're trying to get to. Because most people, I think, I mean, if you have the internet, you have seen a million different swing thoughts. Yeah. You know, like if you like golf and you're going, all right, well, how am I going to get better? What can I do? I'm going to, you know, whatever. I'd search it on Instagram, search it on YouTube, watch it on TV. There's so much information out there. If you kind of know what you're looking for, you could probably figure it out. But at the same time, if you only kind of know what you're looking for, you're going to find a lot of things that are going to mess you up.
Yeah.
And so,
for sure. You're going to lead you down the wrong way.
Yeah. Yeah. And so most of the lessons I give now, it's almost like, okay, stop thinking about all of that. Let's just think about this one thing, because that's the one thing, if that clicked with you, that's the one thing you need to work on. Because most people do the same wrong stuff. But they do the same wrong stuff because they're thinking about something different than what that other person mm-hmm. was thinking about. And so the goal, I think, is almost, I tell people, is I'm going to throw darts at you until one of them sticks. It's like, so we're going to try to fix the same thing with, you know, with each different feel or thought. But I guess that would be my style. But I don't want to, I'm not going to tell, you know, you the same thing that I would tell my sister or, mm-hmm. you know, whoever else, some junior that I'm teaching. Y'all might need to do the exact same thing. But if I told you, you know, to feel whatever, let's say I want you to, you know, I don't know, shorten up in your backswing a little mm-hmm. bit. But maybe your backswing is long because you're actually over rotating. All of a sudden you can't hardly see the ball, whatever, you're going past parallel, but it has yeah. nothing to do with your arms because you're strong enough to control your arms. They don't get, you know, they don't travel too far behind you, so you're not out of sync or whatever it is. Well, whereas my sister, she doesn't over rotate, but her arms, because she's so flexible, they're like wrapped around behind her head.
Yeah.
And so for her, I would basically make her feel like she doesn't move her arms at all and she just turns. Whereas for you, I would just tell you to stop turning your hips as much mm-hmm. or stop, you know, trying to get so much out of it. Feel like it's a three-quarter swing.
Yeah.
Whereas for her, she needs to feel like a full swing, but like her arms didn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
But
that makes sense. Like everybody's different. So something small, you can tell the same person the same thing over and over again, but it's not gonna, like, until you kind of shape it a different way, yeah. then it might click for them.
Yeah.
And they might understand it.
And that's basically, I would say, 80% of a lesson is me going, all right, hit five shots doing this, and we'll see if that changes it. And if it doesn't, but we'll try a different feel, because golf is feel. You know, you don't see your swing. You can't see what you're mm-hmm. doing. You have to feel what you're doing. And so I'll kind of, you know, especially with juniors, I will put them in a position and say, remember this position. You have to feel this. You have mm-hmm. to get here. And some people, I mean, it clicks instantly. It is amazing sometimes. Some kids have completely blown me away. I've just been, oh my gosh, you're a savant. You know, like you just got it. Like, you just go play golf now. You're good.
Yeah.
Whereas other people, you have to put them in that same position over and over and over again before they finally get it. But it's almost always the same exact thing. Every person has their own thing that they do wrong, and once you kind of figure it out, I'm not kidding, they could work on it forever. They could slightly overcook their fix mm-hmm. and then as soon as you tell them, all right, stop thinking about that, they're so far back to where they were, you know. It's like instant, everybody kind of gets right back to where they're comfortable.
If like a lot of my buddies and amateurs say they're trying to break 90 or break 100, what would you say they need to focus? Like, how can you shave shots off your score the quickest?
Yeah, and I think that there is a break point for like 90 and 100. Most 90 shooters, I say most, hit it okay. And when I say okay, they kind of know that it's going to slice every time, or they kind of know that it's going to hook every time, whatever it is. But their short game is terrible. Most amateurs, their short game is terrible because that's not fun to work on.
Yeah.
Why is that? No. Like, you want to go hit the ball. Like, you hit it hard, and that's, you know, that's why guys, I think, like, you know, hitting it far. Because when you hit it hard and it goes far, that's cool. That's fun.
Yeah.
When you hit some little chip shot from just off the edge of the green, you're like, eh, well, whatever. That's what I'm supposed to do.
and you think it should be easier, maybe? That's shorter yes. shot. Is
it
not
should
as long.
Be easier. It should be. But that's where I think most people would save. A 90 shooter would probably save 8 shots a round if their short game got good.
Dang.
And they all of a sudden become like a low 80 shooter, probably. That's not everyone,
yep.
but most of
a
them.
A lot.
Yes. And now I think once you get to the 100 shooter, is we got to figure out how to get it in the fairway
yeah.
and close to the green.
And course management.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
dude, come on, don't hit that shot.
Yeah. yeah, that that's something to me. Everyone seems to expect more out of themselves than they're capable mm-hmm. of. Especially when distance is concerned. Oh, yeah, everybody has it so far. I hit a 300. I
yeah.
did, I swear. It's kind of like, I think it's somewhat like how tall are you kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Are you really 6 feet tall? Because I'm 6 feet tall.
yeah, man, I'm yeah, 6 feet.
I think that's sort of a little bit like it's an ego thing. But I also think that they hit a shot one time that went that far.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, yeah, well, that's how far I hit. I hit my 7-iron 170 because whatever, you know, it went 170 on this one shot, this
yep.
one time. I hit it terrible the rest of the time, but I'm expecting this one, the next
every
one,
to time,
170. And then you kind of watch them hit a few shots, and you're like, well, yeah, like 145
yeah.
for 7-iron. And that's something I think that's hard to talk people into, you know, clubbing up. But that's, I would say that's a pretty big mistake that most amateurs make. They need to hit more club. And then just, yeah, just practicing like bunker shots. A bunker shot should be the easiest shot on the golf course. Because you don't even need to make good contact with the
yeah,
ball to hit a halfway, yeah, to hit a halfway decent bunker shot.
Have you followed the Brooks versus Bryson drama?
No. Oh, kind of. I think so. My dad sent me a text. He said, "Watch this." And it was the video of Brooks sitting there doing the interview,
yeah.
and kind of, you know, whatever, rolling his eyes, and then Bryson walks by. That was maybe one of the funniest things I've ever
It was
seen.
Hilarious.
Yes. That because it's like Brooks has no time for any of that. He's got no patience for it. He thinks it's so over the top, whatever. Because he's such a natural player,
mm-hmm.
he can't wrap his head around taking that much time and thinking about it that much. That drives him crazy. And just having to watch somebody do that, I think, be, you know, the way that they're so polar opposite of each other. And I think the Bryson's response with the something about living rent-free in your head or
yeah,
whatever,
yeah, yeah.
and then there was a picture or whatever of Brooks and then Bryson's inside of his head and all that stuff. That was funny. But I think it's good for golf.
Me too.
Honestly.
A little rivalry.
Yes. And golf is boring if you don't play. And even if you do play, just watching it, you know, you need somebody to pull for. You need something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's why I think that's why basketball and football and any other sport where it's active a lot is fun to watch because there's a lot going on. There aren't that many lulls. And if there are, they're expected.
Yeah.
Whereas,
like a timeout or...
Yes.
Ball goes out of bounds. Yeah, for
and,
sure.
And when you're watching... you know, a game or a match or whatever, you're watching it because you know that team or whoever, you have someone to pull for.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in golf, there's so many guys playing and there's so many different guys playing good, whatever, at whatever time, other than, you know, Tiger, you might not get to see the guy you're pulling for, even if they're playing good.
Yeah.
And
not on TV.
Yes. Yeah. So from that perspective, I think golf can get boring. So to have something with some drama, to have, you know, something different happening,
yeah.
that's not just like, oh yeah, so-and-so shot 65 today.
How's Bill doing?
He's doing good. He his game right now is really, really good, not in a tournament.
Gotcha.
And it's just, he just doesn't trust himself.
Dude, when I played in front of him, every shot I saw on the green behind me was like 5 feet.
Yeah. Yep. He doesn't hardly hit a bad shot. He putts good. He chips good. Like, he doesn't, he looks like what he looked like, you know, 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And
you would say he's going to get back?
Yeah. I think if he can, it's all mental. Mm-hmm. If he can start to trust himself again and be confident, yeah. I mean, yes. Like, he knows
he has it.
He is really good.
Yeah.
And he just doesn't trust his putting. And then if he doesn't putt good, you know, that stresses your iron play, mm-hmm. and you're
going to get it closer.
Yep. And then let's say you do putt good for a couple, you know, for whatever amount of time. Well, when, and then all of a sudden now you're thinking like, well, when's it going to stop? You know, when am I going to, as soon as you hit one bad putt, you're like,
I'm back.
Obviously I missed that putt. I'm never going to make another putt again in my life. And everybody's that way. And I think the guys that stay good for a long time, stuff like that doesn't bother them. Mm-hmm. Webb Simpson, the first tournament he ever won, he used to shank the ball a lot, like once a week kind of thing. And he won at Greensboro, and Bill was paired with him in the first two rounds. And he started off first hole, whatever, second hole, not great, but fine, you know, par. And then the third hole, he shanked a 6-iron into the trees, and it almost, it was going out of bounds, and hit a tree, kicked back down, went in the water. And then he tried to play it out, and it didn't come out, and he ended up making double. And then the next hole, he hit it right, almost like through the fairway, maybe pretty close to out of bounds, and then didn't get down on the green, made bogey. So now he's 3 over after 4. And on 5, this par 5 down the hill, hits it down there. Now he's got 6-iron from the middle of the fairway. The ball's below his feet. And now he's got the same club that he just shanked it with 2 holes before, and he hit it to 2 feet, tapped it in for eagle. I think he made the turn at one under or something like that. And that just blew my mind that he could have the confidence after shanking it to hit a decent
trust.
Shot. Yeah. And when the ball's below your feet like that, that's actually an easy shot to shank.
Yeah.
So if you've just shanked on 2 holes before the same club, that was amazing. And so I think the guys that do stay good week in and week out, they just, it's almost like they don't care if they hit a mm-hmm. bad shot. Doesn't matter. Like, whatever, I'll just go good and hit it better from there. And going all the way back to when I started playing good, it was almost like the same thing. Like, that was what I thought. Mm-hmm. So I think once he can kind of get his mind there, where it's almost like, well, if I miss a 3-foot putt or a 4-foot yeah. putt, whatever, it's not a big deal because I'm good. I'm putting good.
You should knock it in from 3.5 feet.
Yes.
What, if people want to come get a lesson from you, mm-hmm. how do they do that?
So I've had some issues with this recently, but if you go to HaasFamilyGolf.com, you can click on my name, whatever. There's a whole thing. You can like select the day that you would like to do it and select like a time range or whatever, mm-hmm. and it'll kind of spit it out. If I have that time available, if I don't, I don't even know if you can select it. But it's just, I mean, it's your typical, you know,
yeah.
go through the jump through the hoops, kind of, you know, put your name down, whatever. And there is a thing that you can kind of fill out and say what you want to work on, stuff like that.
Nice.
But yeah, I've had an issue the last like week and a half, stuff not going to my calendar. And then when I put stuff in my calendar, it doesn't go and block it off. So people are like, this morning, somebody had booked a lesson for 10 a.m. I'm like, oh, I thought I fixed this. So it's been a little bit frustrating here recently, but it's been so nice being able to do that and not needing somebody to have my phone number or yeah. whatever and having to text me.
And just book it online.
Yes.
Almost like a haircut or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, well, that way they don't have to wait for me to respond. You know, they just go and they can book it whenever yeah. they want. You can book it at midnight if you're, you know, like all of a sudden you know, you're out with your buddies and they're talking about how good they hit it.
All right, well, let's go get a lesson.
Yes. So you can do that, you know, that's just easier, I think.
Yeah, so people go book with Jay and start getting better at golf. Right?
Yeah.
Well, Jay, this has been a pleasure having you on. Thank you for taking the time. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. It was good to talk to you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode. If you did, click subscribe on your listening platform for upcoming conversations.